This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, we're talking about efforts in Lee County to change the comprehensive development plan to allow more rock mining and allow industrial and commercial development on some wetlands. But first, Lake O releases high-volume releases of nutrient-rich and blue-green algae-laden water from Lake Okeechobee last summer led to massive algae blooms along the Caloosahatchee River, in Cape Coral canals, and in the river's estuary. This all happened as a prolonged red tide bloom persisted along the southwest Florida coast. Now, three conservation groups are suing three federal agencies for what they say is a failure to address the harm inflicted on Florida's endangered species by calling for these releases. The lawsuit was filed in the Southern District of Florida by the Center for Biological Diversity, Colusa Waterkeeper, and the Waterkeeper Alliance against the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the National Marine Fisheries Service. Much of it comes down to the release schedule used by the Corps to determine when to release water and how much to release. The Corps says it plans to update that schedule once repairs to the Herbert Hoover Dike are complete, but that's years away at least, and these conservation groups say we need to act now. Joining me to discuss the lawsuit and the current state of the lake and river as we head into rainy season is John Cassani. He is a Colusa waterkeeper. John, welcome back to the show.
Hey, hello, Julie.
And Jacqueline Lopez. She is the Florida director at the Center for Biological Diversity. Jacqueline, thanks for joining us.
Hey, you're welcome. Good afternoon.
And as always, we invite you to join our conversation. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. John, I remember talking with you about this back in November when you originally announced the intent to sue back in December of last year. What did that trigger, just the announcement of it?
Well, basically, that was a notice of intent to sue, and It's the process requires a 60-day notice, and we gave the agencies a 60-days notice, and there's been some back and forth since then. They asked for an extension. We gave it to them, and we made several attempts to try to come to some kind of an agreement or settlement on it, but let Jackie opine on that a little bit more, but that's kind of where we're at now. We've filed the petition, and we're going forward.
So Jacqueline, what then happened, the back and forth, and what were you hoping might come from that back and forth?
The allegations that we raise in our notice of intent to sue are nothing new to Floridians in South Florida. So we talk a lot about the harmful algal blooms and the failure of the Army Corps as well as the wildlife management agencies to take into account the effects that the harmful algal blooms are having on communities and wildlife. And so what our notice letter asked for and what we were hoping to achieve and what we have now alleged in our federal complaint is that the agencies haven't analyzed this information. It's well known now that the Lake O releases are causing or contributing to the proliferation of toxic algae and that wildlife and humans are being exposed to them. And we are just now starting to collect information on that. But with respect to how Lake Okeechobee is managed, how the waters are discharged, how the entire schedule of managing Lake Okeechobee has never considered harmful algal blooms in the Army Corps' operation of the lake. So that's what we were hoping to get, is a true assessment of the effects, a real analysis, common sense would dictate that you have to look at the effects of your action before you take them, and especially when we have this seasonal reoccurrence of these blooms and impacts to our coastal communities, you can't keep ignoring the effects. And so you have to start looking closely at what's happening and determining, you know, what measures might be appropriate to address them.
So the main crux of your lawsuit centers around the Endangered Species Act, right, Jacqueline?
It's both the Endangered Species Act, and that's the thing that we were required to give notice on.
Okay.
But it also talks about the National Environmental Policy Act, which is this law that was established by Congress to both inform the public. It's one of those, it doesn't require any type of substantive result, but it's one of those informational laws that says that when an agency undertakes an action, it has an obligation to research it really well and to inform the public and have the public's involvement. So the two claims involve the Endangered Species Act issues as well as the National Environmental Policy Act issues. And the purpose of that informational purpose is to protect the human environment. So mm-hmm. our coastal communities, how they're being affected, and giving people an opportunity to learn more about and have a say in how they're being impacted by the regulation of the lake.
So, John, we've talked a lot about this, obviously, for the last, well, I don't know, since I even started here.
Right.
And it seems like the decision-making on the part of the Army Corps of Engineers has always been based on protecting from the Herbert Hoover Dyke, which is not in great shape but still being redone. The thing that the Army Corps of Engineers tends to say is we don't want that dike to break and to flood areas. Is that's the only, it seems like, from what I understand, the only criteria that's being used to make the decision to get the water out of the lake so you don't put as much pressure on the dike. Is this correct?
I think it's more complex than that, actually, Julie. I think, you know, there's three paradigms to operating the schedule. One is flood control. Another is water supply. Mm-hmm. And the one that doesn't get the equity that we would like to see is fish and wildlife. Fish and wildlife are actually defined as existing legal users, and the Corps is supposed to balance how they regulate that lake with consideration of fish and wildlife. And I guess we would respectfully argue that they are not doing that well enough.
And so saying we're going to file this lawsuit, the hope was for them to say, okay, well, you know, let's come to an agreement on how we could consider how we weigh these things. That hasn't happened. This is going forward into a lawsuit stage.
Yeah, so those that are reluctant to see the schedule change are those that typically benefit a lot from the way it's operated now, the status quo now. And so we're trying to move kind of past that into a, perhaps a more progressive and equitable schedule that balances the outcome of the schedule a little bit more in the context of fish and wildlife. There are incredible public health risk elements to this policy now. I think there's even some federal legislation in the works that may require, if it passes, a better notification of when toxic algae is moving downstream into the coastal communities. We need to know that.
But how does that even help? What are you going to do?
Well, you know, we need to shift. We need to shift from this paradigm we're in now where we just pretty much are documenting the occurrence of these problems. We're not in a progressive way trying to manage them. So we need to be looking at all the elements, all the parameters that seem to trigger these harmful algal blooms so that when we know those, we can predict in a way so the managers can change the way they operate the schedule of the lake in a useful and in an equitable way. Right now, that's just not happening. We have a lot of information out there. It's just not being used and modeled in order to kind of get ahead of the curve on the problems that result from year in and year out. I mean, these aren't new occurrences.
No.
I mean, this has been happening for a very, very long time, and it's time we need to move forward.
So I want to ask both of you, and I'm wondering, we were talking about different acts and different – the information one that Jacqueline just mentioned. What about the Clean Water Act? Doesn't that prohibit moving polluted water from one place to another in a lot of cases? Anyone?
Yes. Ordinarily it would, and actually there's some – it gets kind of wonky, but there's some case law that was established a few years ago, actually by the Miccosukee tribe in the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the jurisdiction that Florida falls under, that found that if you're moving polluted water from one area to another area, that's considered a pollutant under the Clean Water Act. And then Congress later amended the Clean Water Act so that it would no longer be considered a pollutant. So there's, we are concerned about the water quality. That's a big issue, and that's an issue that both the states and the Florida and the Army Corps has an obligation to address. The other piece of the puzzle is the water quantity and the fact that we have a dramatically altered natural landscape. Lake Okeechobee was never in its natural state, was not a reservoir. It was a slow-moving body of water that was just this giant depression in the state of Florida where water would flow south before entering into the lower Everglades area. And now that it has a massive dam around it, it functions as a reservoir. And it will be difficult to achieve true Everglades restoration and parity for the coastal communities until there is a solution with how you're going to move the volume of water that flows in through the Kissimmee and into the lake and through the 14 watersheds that are north of the lake down into the Everglades where it's needed. And so it's both a water quality problem as well as a water quantity problem, and that has to do with just the urban legacy that is now Florida. I mean, we've dramatically changed what all of Florida, but in particular here, what central and southern Florida looks like, and have, you know, benefited economically from it. We've been able to put a lot of people there and put a lot of agriculture there, but it's not part of the natural ecology of what that area once looked like. And so there's, you know, we got to have compromises in all ends. And so the water quantity issue is another significant piece of the puzzle.
Well, the water quantity is something that we all watch with cringing anticipation every spring as we start heading into the wet season when it rains every single day. We always are very nervous about the Lake Okeechobee water levels. And John, I feel like this year, correct me if I'm wrong, the Army Corps of Engineers allowed the levels of the lake to remain a little bit lower than they usually do going into the rainy season?
Yeah, is a lot of moving parts to why policy changes. And, you know, it's good to see the Corps actually departing from the lake schedule, using their ability to have flexibility to make these changes. So I know there's been some screaming about the lake got too low, and we're really not seeing that as a problem. But now, as a result, we have another foot, maybe a million acre feet of freeboard in the lake this year that may not translate into damaging discharges during the summer, during the wet season. So that's good. You know, and a lot of us are scratching our head. You know, why didn't this occur
last year?
The last two decades or three decades. I mean, why weren't we using this flexibility?
Well, it seems like there was political will and pressure to do so.
Well, the old saying is, if you know, there's never enough science if there's no political will, and that's kind of the paradigm we've been in from time to time. And I think everybody gets that, but I think we're kind of at that stage where everybody thinks we, based on what happened last year in 2016 and years before, we really need to change sooner than later in terms of policies and outcomes on the lake schedule.
And I know I was really surprised when I talked a couple years ago to a U.S. Army Corps of Engineer representative about the rehabilitation work that's being done on the Herbert Hoover Dyke around the lake. And he wasn't able to say with certainty that the release schedule would change all that much even after all the repairs are complete. They're not even sure that even after they do this, the lake would be able to hold more water.
Yeah, my understanding along the way, and Jackie may have some thoughts on this as well, but you know, the echoes I'm hearing from the Corps is we're not going, even after the dike's repaired, we're not going to raise the lake, you know, back into that higher ceiling, and that's just so damaging to the lake itself, in so many different ways. And so, but during that same period of time, I'm hearing certain policymakers thinking this is the easy compromise to get to all those water supply and flood control things they also need to cover, and it's just not going to really work for the fish and wildlife end of things. Yeah.
If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with John Cassani from Calusa Waterkeeper and Jacqueline Lopez from the Center for Biological Diversity about the lawsuit those two groups, along with the Waterkeeper Alliance, have filed against the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the National Marine Fisheries Service. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, do they completely independently create this schedule, or is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the National Marine Fisheries Service, involved in that decision-making process, setting that release schedule?
Jackie, you want to take that one?
The Army Corps, yeah. So the Army Corps ultimately has the authority and responsibility for managing the lake. The Army Corps also has an obligation to comply with federal statutes, including federal environmental statutes, which require that the Army Corps consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service for impacts to our marine and freshwater species. And so in the process of consulting with those agencies, all the agencies have to disclose and evaluate the impacts of the proposed activity. And if it turns out that the activity is going to jeopardize the continued existence of a species, then there needs to be alternatives implemented to the proposed activity. And even if you don't reach a level of finding that the species would be jeopardized, but rather that there will be impacts, those species will be harassed or harmed or killed, then you can implement reasonable and prudent measures that you investigate and agree upon, you being the Army Corps and the Fish and Wildlife Service agree upon, are necessary to help minimize and mitigate further damages of the project. So while it's ultimately the Army Corps' responsibility to manage the lake, it has a concurrent obligation to comply with the federal laws, and those federal laws include talking to the different agencies and carrying out their functions to protect wildlife and to protect humans.
So does this lawsuit specifically ask for, I guess it's saying that they're not doing that.
That's right. Yeah, the allegations, and they aren't. They are not. That's actually not in dispute at this time.
So what are you hoping then for this lawsuit to actually bring about?
Really, it is just for the Army Corps to make good on their promises to these communities and to talk to the wildlife management agencies early and often, to fully vet what the problems are with the current Lake Okeechobee management, to look for solutions moving forward, and to implement those measures as soon as possible, to not wait until the Herbert Hoover dike repairs are completed, which best case scenario would be 2022. That 2022 date is about a decade overdue. The deadline for completing the repairs to the dike has been kicked down the road for many, many years, sometimes due to funding, sometimes due to additional engineering or scientific research that discovers that different repairs are required. But as John already mentioned, that even when the dike repairs are completed, it's unlikely that the Corps will be able to manage the lake at a higher level because of impacts to the ecology. And also reports that, currently we have a Category 1 dike safety concern. So that's the most at-risk dike, at most at risk for failure. With the dike repairs, it's only going to knock it down to a Category 2, a Level 2. So, it's going to be a chronic issue dealing with the lake. And if there is a desire in Florida and in the United States, Everglades National Park is a national and international treasure. If there's a true desire to restore the Everglades, it's going to take getting much, much more of the water that is currently stored in Lake Okeechobee as a reservoir, mostly for agricultural uses, and moving that water down south through the Everglades, through the area that was historically known as the Everglades. That's the only way we're going to get restoration. And, incidentally, it's the only way we're going to get the pressure relieved off of the estuaries.
Well, this is such a complex puzzle. I mean, there's so many pieces to it. We've talked on the show recently about the South Florida Water Management District's ongoing construction of a huge C-43 reservoir out near Alva. They're looking for a way to ensure that the water that it will someday contain does not get fouled by an algae bloom. John, what do you know about that, and what do you think that it will take to accomplish that goal?
Yeah, so that the EAA, Everglades Agricultural Area Reservoir, as it's sometimes called, is a hydrologic restoration project primarily. But, we've had this trend of diminishing water quality through the last decade or so in Florida, and so we're having to build these massive filter marshes in order so that this water, you can legally discharge it. It isn't so polluted once it goes in the reservoir that you can legally meet those state surface water quality standards so you can discharge it further south. That's been one of the big issues all along, is getting that 10 part per billion water quality threshold for phosphorus into the Everglades. And so we're getting pretty close to that now. But, there are these technicalities with water quality now that complicate hydrologic restoration. And so same thing for the C-43 reservoir. There's some uncertainty that, it'll meet those surface water quality standards for discharge. And, these are complex and hard issues. The legacy pollutant issue is enormous in the state of Florida, and it's really not getting all that much better. So we've got to act sooner than later, and I hope the reservoir will, you know, Congress will fully fund that here in the near future, and we can get on with, you know, doing what we need to do with the reservoir.
It kind of feels like we're trying to create a sculpture out of marble with toothpicks here. It's like we're a lot of tiny, like, I mean, it's a huge, massive undertaking to rebuild what we've completely altered and changed here in Florida with the Everglades. But there's a little project here, and then there's a project here, but it's probably not going to be enough. But then this project, can all of these smaller, I mean, they're big, you know, but relative to what's actually needed, can they ever be enough to fix what's already been done?
Yeah, there's so many competing uses for the water. I mean, you know, we're growing at 1,000 people a day again, and the demand for allocating that water for public use is enormous. It creates a political pressure to succumb to those forces. We're seeing that more so than ever. What's making it even harder is the climate change. There's so much uncertainty now with rainfall and extreme storm events. It makes it hard to predict what you need to do to restore a resource because there's so much uncertainty with climate change. So, yeah, that toothpick is getting a little dull around the edges, I think. But I'm hopeful that we will move forward in a better way in the near future, sooner than later.
We have a call coming in from David in Fort Myers. David, what would you like to ask about?
Well, I just wanted to comment on this. I'm a water guy, and I grew up on Fort Myers Beach, and been in the water industry in South Florida for many years. I'm a hydrologist, and I've just watched the water quality continue to degrade. And we've seen, you know, as your guests have mentioned, you know, we've seen this blue-green algae in the past, and just, you know, it continues to get worse. And I wanted to express my gratitude that we're finally got some people here that are going to take the agencies to task and try to get some action. It's been so long, and I've watched Lee County and people in the area try to work with the agencies, and that just hasn't worked well. And I've just had such a love for the area. And with the overdevelopment and then these water problems, it's just heartbreaking for me. And I just wanted to say thank you to these people, and I hope we can get some positive results.
Thanks, David, for your comment. I really appreciate it. And what he brings up is an interesting point. There's been, you know, complaints and trying to work with, and, but was it last year that just finally pushed this group of three organizations to finally bring it to a federal lawsuit level, Jacqueline?
Yeah, it was just the hearing stories like David's and knowing that there are so many people out there that are likewise suffering. And people, they stay in Florida or they move to Florida because of our great outdoors. That's why people live here. We've got so many natural, wonderful things to enjoy about being on the water, close to the water, and to see year after year that just be, it's disgusting. It's sad, it's sickening, and people are starting to not just have these aesthetic impacts and sort of lifestyle choice impacts, but are their human health, they're suffering. And, we've just been waiting for so long for change, promises that the dike repairs will be completed. And once once those are done, we'll have a new way of managing the lake, and just slowly coming to the realization that that probably wasn't going to happen unless we acted.
Really forced the issue. John, what is the current state of the lake and the river in terms of the presence of blue-green algae? How's it looking now?
It's been quite variable so far this year, 2019. We had what looked like a really early bloom formation in the estuary, and we didn't see that last year till July, but that seems to have ebbed a little bit. And so this may be a response to maybe that additional flexibility that the core is, you know, they're not these massive pulses that load up the system right away. And we're understanding more and more of what the underlying causes might be. But right now, for red tide, I think the last report had some background levels in Manatee County, but it's been pretty quiet on the red tide front, thank goodness. And So we've had some sporadic blooms in the freshwater reach as well, but nothing compared to last year. So we're kind of holding our breath, hoping that, you know, we won't see a repeat. But we're just beginning the wet season, and you know,
I know.
You just need to be cautious.
This is the point at which every time it rains, I cringe. I get a little scared. Yep. And that knocking sound in the background was me knocking on wood when you said that so far still just background levels and smaller. Have you heard anything about these blue-green algae showing up in little ponds, the retention ponds? Have you seen reports of this?
Yeah, so there's this mosaic of what we call regulatory wet detention ponds throughout the region, actually throughout Florida, and they're required for every development to treat stormwater. Lots of moving parts and problems with how those work and how we presume them to be compliant, and that's a big problem because largely they are not. That's my opinion. So we see these things enriched with nutrients, and after 6 or 7 years of sequestering pollutants, they get pretty nasty. And one of the manifestations of that accumulation is cyanobacteria blooms, blue-green algae blooms. So yes, we do see them. The downside of that is they're in proximity to high density where people live. I mean,
yeah, they're the ponds that are make it a waterfront home every time you buy a new house here. So I'm wondering, I mean, they're usually the homes that have beautiful green lawns that have fertilizer and chemicals that have been put on those lawns, and that just goes right into that pond. I mean, should maybe homeowners organizations be aware of the fact that making those pretty lawns happen could be making that pond into something that could have some health impacts for the people enjoying the view?
Yeah, so the fertilizer ordinances are in effect. There's a blackout period during the summer. I think those are all good and progressive ways to try to get at this problem. But these ponds were meant to detain pollutants, and they become cumulative through time. So after 7 or 8 years, even though you're reducing it, you're still loading these little ponds up to some degree.
Well, we've all seen what happened after the Hurricane Irma went over Lake Okeechobee and kind of churned all that up, and we've still been feeling the impacts of that.
Yeah, and again, I was just going to say the public health aspects now, that's front and center on everyone's mind. That's why you were knocking on wood a couple minutes ago is because, you know, it isn't just an aesthetic problem like Jackie said. There's a very significant public health issue. We've got another town hall coming up on June 24th.
That's a week from today.
Yeah. So we'll have those doctors, epidemiologists, and coming over and answering questions that people are concerned about public health. I mean, I get calls every week. You know, I've sold my property. I'm gone. I've left the area. I don't trust government to fix this. That's tragic, and we hope to not let that continue.
And that event is June 24th, Monday. It's called Public Health Alert Florida Water, and it runs from 5:30 to 9 o'clock in the evening at Broadway Palm Dinner Theater. The address there is 1380 Colonial Boulevard in Fort Myers. And, of course, there's more information at gulfcoastlive.org if you're looking to find out more about that event that's coming up a week from today. A lot of people with a lot of questions, I expect. I remember last year when you did a few of these. There were some packed houses.
Yeah, and the thing that just blew the top off this issue last year was inhalation toxicity. People thought, well, you know, I have to get in the water, I have to swim, I may even have to ingest it to experience risk. Now we understand there is risk associated with actually just breathing the airborne toxins that are in some proximity to these bloom effects. So, you know, that now includes a much, much bigger pool of people that could be exposed to the risk.
And how far it can travel, which was surprising.
I'm not an expert in that area, but I'm hearing
it goes
early
away.
Studies, you know, a mile maybe. So the work that FGCU did last summer that Dr. Parsons did, you know, they were focusing on Cape Coral, but they were getting background concentrations in Bonita Springs, some 20-odd miles away. And so there's a lot more we need to know about concentrations and how much risk that proposes to people. But we're getting there, and I'm hopeful that there'll be adequate public health notice in the future.
And as you mentioned earlier, there are people that left. They said they don't trust the government to solve this problem. Of course, this lawsuit is going to be an attempt to try to hold these government agencies accountable. And Jacqueline, I wanted to ask you, what's next for the lawsuit? How are things going to proceed, and what kind of timeline do you think you're dealing with, or do you even know?
The Army Corps has about 60 days to respond to the complaint, so to go through and respond to all the allegations we raise and We're hopeful, though, that we can reach some resolution with the agencies to just get them to do the right thing. I mean, it's like I said before, it's common sense just to understand what you're working with, to really understand better what is so self-evident to everybody else in the area experiencing these harmful effects. And so they do have some time to respond to the complaint, and if we're unable to reach some sort of resolution with them, then we will have to move forward with litigation. And that takes, that can take a few months, it can take up to a year.
Well, I'd be surprised if they come to you. I mean, after the way they've kind of altered their behavior this spring so far, if they come and say, you know what, you're right, we really should do that and we're going to do it. Would that make you happy if they come up with a plan of how they're actually going to work with these other agencies and make better decisions?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's not just that it's required by law. It is. But it's also what the public demands and needs. They have the agencies have the best access to the information. They have the best means for understanding it. And ultimately, they're responsible for doing these discharges and managing the lake the way that they do. So it is ultimately their responsibility. But there's also a moral obligation. And this is our community. This is where we live. These are our neighbors, and by neighbors I mean our dolphins, our manatees, our small tooth sawfish, as well as our neighbors, our people that live next door to us. We're a big community, and there's an obligation to do right by that community and by the communities of coastal Florida. So I remain hopeful that we'll get this done and we'll get it done quickly.
It'll be interesting to see what happens next, and we'll be keeping an eye on it. That's all the time that we have for this part of the show, though, and I want to thank my guest, John Cassani, the Caluso Otter Keeper. John, thanks for your time, as always.
Thank you, Julie.
I also want to thank Jacqueline Lopez, Florida Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. Jacqueline, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
When we return, we're going to learn about efforts by the Lee County Commission to change the county's comprehensive land use plan, which could allow more lime rock mining and possibly allow for more industrial and commercial development on areas designated as wetlands. We're joined by senior environmental planning specialist from the Conservancy of Southwest Florida and a Fort Lauderdale-based land use and environmental law attorney to get the latest. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.